Greg Feldberg of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Hi, I was expecting your call, thanks.
And no, thank you. Thank you for agreeing to speak with us.
My pleasure.
I've got a couple of colleagues here.
Okay.
So why doesn't everybody introduce themselves?
I'm Kim Schaefer.
I'm Scott.
Hi.
Scott Gans.
I'm Mike Easterly.
And
sorry?
Mike Easterly.
Okay.
And Jeff Smith.
Okay.
So, and if you don't mind, we've been tape recording all of our interviews unless you object to that.
No, that's no problem. What are you going to do with this?
So I guess that with that as an intro, I guess we're just running the recording now. So this is Greg Feldberg. I'm here with Professor German. And I guess the first question is, just in your words, what are the most important things we should focus on as causes of the crisis?
That's difficult. I mean, I'm just talking on the fly, but you mentioned there were 23 things, and I don't think there is one cause of the crisis. I think too much leverage, too much easy credit, wrong incentives for Wall Street in terms of compensation and making money. Too many people able to play with other people's money and not playing with their own money anymore. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, assisted housing. I can go on.
Mm-hmm. Have you in your own research? What's your focus is on drivatives?
Yeah, I'm mostly a derivatives person. My whole life in on Wall Street has really been on how to value complex derivatives, how to value derivatives in general, how to trade volatility. So I've never really worked on CDOs, although I sort of understand them in a qualitative sort of way, but I never worked hands-on on them. I mostly worked on fixed income and equity derivatives.
Mm-hmm. So we certainly got theories about how. About derivatives' role in the crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to hear your views on it.
On derivatives in general, or on derivatives in the crisis?
In the crisis, yeah.
I suppose most of it is involved mortgage derivatives and CDOs, which, as I say, I haven't worked on directly, but. I can only tell you my prejudices. I mean, I'm always surprised that people expect so much of models. In that, if you ever work hands-on with building models, you know that all your models are primed by assumptions about how people are going to behave in the future. If you build a derivatives model, say an equity derivatives model, in order to value anything, you're making some assumption about what volatility will be in the future. If you build a CDO model, you're making some assumption about what default rates or prepayments or housing prices will do in the future. And the two places models can go wrong. One is the model itself will not be accurate because it's only an approximation. And secondly, the data that you put into it could be wrong. Sometimes people prime their models or calibrate them by making them fit the market prices of liquid instruments and backing out what future parameters of the world make the model match the current prices of liquid instruments and then use them to value illiquid instruments. But I can't understand anymore why people expect that to be right. Am I being clear?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always sort of a little bit, I'm not sure, I was always in that camp. I mean, maybe 20 years ago I wasn't, but now, sort of for the last 15 or 10 years, I can't understand why people expect great accuracy from their models. The models are fraud's the wrong word, they're just not complete. And secondly, it's unlike physics. In physics, you start with the present and you try to forecast where a satellite or a rocket or a shell is going to go in the future, and you really are predicting the future in most derivative models. You're not predicting the future, you're making assumptions about the future in order to calculate the fair value of something today. And if your assumptions about the future are wrong, let alone your assumptions that build the model are wrong, then your answer is going to be no better. So I kind of think of these models as even good derivatives. business models as a way of trying to figure out roughly what an illiquid thing is worth given the price of a bunch of liquid things that you know.
So certainly you find out is not going to be true once you try to sell it.
Say it again?
You're going to find out when you try to sell it that's not the case.
It depends how disruptive the world gets. I mean, you know, for small perturbations about where you are, it's not bad. But when big shocks happen, then you're going to find out that's not the case. It could be not the case good or not the case bad. So I know there have been a lot of people blaming models for the crisis, and I think they certainly played their part. But I'm sort of astounded by people taking models as gospel somehow.
So how do hedge funds and broker dealers in New York think about modeling risk? I mean, do they take this seriously?
Yeah, I worked at Goldman for 17 years, and the last 2 years I was in firm-wide risk from 2000 to mid-2002, where I was in charge of a group called derivatives analysis, where we looked at the risk. We try to verify the marks that traders did on their exotic positions, you know, on their illiquid sort of structured products.
Mm-hmm.
And we always used to argue, and we used to do as best as we could, that the right way to do it was to use a variety of models that fit current. There are many different models. I was working mostly on equity derivatives, but there are many different models that all fit, that can be forced to fit the current price of liquid instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you cover illiquid instruments, they've got a certain amount of uncertainty. We would argue that you ought to use several different models to see what the range of values you might get are.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have time, that's what we would do, to check the trader's mark. And then more sophisticatedly, I wrote a paper about this once, actually. I can send it to you if you want.
Yeah.
Should I email it to whom?
Mine is G. .gov.
Okay. I've got a paper that I wrote once I was at Goldman in Risk Magazine about how to market liquid products. And one of the things we used to do was, am I being germane to what you're interested in here?
Yeah.
Okay. And one of the things we used to do was say, if you've got any liquid product, you can't really sell it. So you have to hedge it until it expires. And we would run simulations of how the traders would hedge it, even if their model wasn't right, what they would do. Do you follow what I mean? Like maybe Black-Scholes wasn't right, but they would use Black-Scholes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then run simulations of what sort of P&L they might earn over the lifetime of the security, hedging it the way they hedged it, and making assumptions about what the market would do, the range of scenarios that the market might undergo. And then you would get a sort of distribution of what the mean profit was, or what the mean value of the security was, but also a standard deviation of, you know, when you did better or when you did worse. And we would argue that you should mark it at the mean, but take a reserve, so to speak, for the error that you might have. And we would actually do that for, this was back in 2000, there was some, I can't remember what it was, there was some long-term options that Goldman owned that they sold to people. They were not sophisticated. They had sophisticated ones too. They were fairly simple options, but they had a long lifetime. Say options on Microsoft or something that somebody from some Microsoft restricted stock, you know, 100 millionaire has sold. You know what I mean?
So, do you look in retrospect as this as effective, or was even your efforts to do this, not enough to take into account the uncertainty?
Yeah, we used to take into account the uncertainty and hold a reserve against the position, meaning they couldn't say, you know, if I'm making this up, but if they bought it for $5 million and then they said the way they marketed it was really worth $6 million, we wouldn't let them say they just made $1 million, but say that they made something that there was an uncertainty about it that you wouldn't credit to their P&L until it was actually realized.
I guess what I'm saying is, was there a systematic underpricing of the reserve? I mean, was the reserve sufficient over time to take that into account?
Look, I wasn't in controllers. I just looked at I was in charge of a group of like maybe 12 or 14 mostly PhDs who just worked on particular, you know, on particular things.
And was it your impression that Goldman was ahead of the pack, or is that what everybody was?
Say it again.
Was it your impression that Goldman was ahead of the pack, or was everybody kind of learning this and doing the same thing?
I don't know, but everybody, I've got to say, every Goldman was they get more sophisticated over time, but I think on the scale of things that I know from people who've worked at other places, they were pretty good. I mean, Goldman was pretty good.
Oh.
But it wasn't a systematic underpricing. I think that's the wrong word. I mean, I'm not saying people didn't do that, I don't know, but our aim wasn't to be systematic underpricing. Our aim was to price at the mean, but allow for the fact that you might make more or you might make less.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to say it was intentional. What I meant was just how did it actually turn out in practice? You know what I mean? Was it possible to actually set the reserve right?
It's very hard to know what right is, but we used to try to persuade the trade on these particular equity derivative deals. Mm-hmm. The traders used to sort of make up intuitively a number for their uncertainty, and one day we cut over to doing it on these equity derivative deals more systematically, and I think they kind of liked it.
Right.
It's hard to know whether your uncertainty estimate was right, but it was a sort of rational way of trying to allow for this uncertainty.
Right.
So for example, if they owned an option, a long-term, a five-year option that was, say, at the money roughly, then there was going to be a lot of hedging risk involved because the hedge ratio was going to change all the time, and so there'd be more transaction costs and more uncertainty. Whereas if the option moved deep in or out of the money, then the delta didn't change very much and there was much less uncertainty.
Right.
But it's a tough problem. I mean, I never really worked on very complicated things like CDOs, I think there are many more assumptions involved in a CDO model than there are in a sort of Black-Scholes type model. You know, Black-Scholes at least is based on hedging and on a bunch of assumptions you can sort of state clearly and then try to look at the world and see to what extent it violates them. Whereas CDO correlation models are not really hedging models, they're just sort of actuarial models and I think sort of less trustworthy.
Do I understand correctly, this is Mike Easterly, that a lot of these models were based upon, statistical or normal distributions or the idea that what I'm trying to get at is, would they really capture things like herding behavior where everybody sort of chases the same profit?
I think, I've been out of this for sort of 7 or 8 years, but I think not. But that's very hard to do, to be fair.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Once you start trying to take account of behavioral stuff, I think it's easier to do in your head and think about how that would affect the parameters in your model than to actually model the, you know, in other words,
yeah.
You say, if everybody goes crazy, volatility is going to triple.
Right.
It's much harder to develop a plausible model and sort of put it all the effort to develop one in which you model that whole cycle of how people feed off each other.
Right.
I think that's very difficult. I would guess it's almost impossible.
So when you say CDO models, you're talking about just even for corporate CDOs. Have you looked at what was used for the ABS CDOs?
No, not directly. But I think the big difference between, well, from a modeling point of view, I think the difference between say Black-Scholes type models and CDO models is that with Black-Scholes, you're really saying if the world is a normal, if the stock market does undergo a random walk and geometric variable motion, and if there are no transaction costs, and if you can hedge, you know, you make a lot of dynamical assumptions, and then you say, okay, this is what it's worth if I were to replicate it. Am I making sense?
Uh-huh.
But I think with CDO models, you're just saying if the correlation is 15% or something, and everything's normal, then this is what you should expect to find for the expected value of the thing. But it's not a way of replicating it. It's just saying this is the mean of the distribution, and if the distribution bigger than that, then that's not the answer. You know, whereas with Black-Scholes, you can say, okay, maybe they're really transaction costs, maybe they're really frictions. There's a way of perturbing about, I mean, the model's perfect under some set of assumptions, and then you can say, if those assumptions don't hold, what will happen? I don't know if I'm being clear here.
Whereas, I mean, CDOs were very vulnerable to the correlation being a lot more than expected, among other things.
Yes.
So, I mean, what can you do about that? Is there a way to model CDOs?
The difference I was kind of trying to say, it's connected with that, but I was saying, I think CDO models are more like sort of actuarial or life insurance models, in the sense you're saying, if everybody dies at a certain rate, then this is what, you know, some life insurance product is worth.
Mm-hmm.
But if they don't die at that rate, then it's worth something different. But it doesn't tell you how to actually make the security, whereas with Black-Scholes, the Black-Scholes model is telling you, if you trade stock, if you borrow money and trade stock at a certain, according to a certain formula, you'll get exactly the same payoff as an option. Am I being sort of clear? It's a manufacturing process.
Right, right.
And so it makes a lot of assumptions about how smooth the manufacturing will be and how smooth the market will be, but it's telling you, under those assumptions, this is how you can synthesize an option out of trading stock. And so if the assumptions aren't true, you can still see what that, you can still sort of calculate the effect that will have on your manufacturing process. Whereas with CDOs, the model, it's sort of like a life insurance model. It just says if everything has this correlation, that's what it's worth. But it doesn't tell you how to actually make it out of things if you don't own them. I don't know if I'm being clear here. Shall I try again?
I think I understand what you're saying.
So in that case,
I'm saying CDO models are in both options models and CDO models, you have to make assumptions about what volatility or what default rates in the future are. But I think traditional option models are, they sort of describe a manufacturing process in which the model says to you, if you buy stock, if whenever the market goes up a little bit, you buy a little bit more stock according to this formula, and if and when it goes down, you sell a little bit and invest the money in a savings account, and you do that consistently, then you will earn the payoff of an option. You know, it's sort of telling you how to make an option out of something else, and that's why people more or less believe it, although it still makes assumptions about volatility. But with the CDO model, it's not a derivative model, and that it's not telling you how to make it without trading the actual things that it's made out of. So it's one step. There's a lot of differences. It's one step more removed from how to make things. And secondly, with option models, there really is a liquid market in the underliers, in the stock, and there's a liquid market in options, and you can measure the volatility of its stock, and you can measure the implied volatility of options. So there's liquid markets all around it, at least in S&P or things like that, whereas in CDOs, although they like to make an analogy to Black-Scholes, you can't really measure default correlation. There just aren't enough defaults happening to measure it accurately, and there isn't a liquid market in the implied products either. So what I'm saying is the analogy with traditional option pricing is a lot shakier.
If I can paraphrase, perhaps what you're saying is that the difference between the option modeling and the CDO modeling is that the option modeling, you have an underlying that has a liquid market, where the CDO, you don't have a liquid market in the underlying.
Yes, that was one of the things. I was trying to say several, and then
okay.
The second one is, in the option market, not only is the underlying liquid, and you can measure the actual parameter, which is the volatility, at least at some instance.
You can basically create.
Whereas in the CDO market,
right.
You can't really.
It
depends on
the
assumption about the default correlation, and you don't see enough defaults to measure that.
Right. Okay. So more of the variables are observable.
You can't sit down one day and say what's the
interesting.
You can look at the S&P today and say it's volatility with
33,
but you can't look at corporate defaults today and say their correlation is 22%.
To another one is really a top-down process.
It's not happening enough. But the land is not being liquid, I guess.
So, just sort of building on that, so it seems like, you know, the Black-Scholes model, sort of this bottom-up process of building, you know, equivalents using different stocks and options, whereas we're talking now about CDO modeling as being sort of like a top-down process, more of an actuarial process.
Yeah, I think, both of them still make neat assumptions about what are the future volatility or what future default rates will be, but CDO is more actuarial. In the sense that it's a statistical calculation, whereas Black-Scholes is a I don't know what to call it. I like to call it a manufacturing calculation. It tells you this is a, sort of Black-Scholes is a bit like making an option. It's like making fruit salad out of fruit, and it says if you buy the fruit and you can it, this is what it will cost you to make a can of fruit under certain assumptions.
So sorry, and this is Scott Gans. So now I guess the question is. To what extent can traders, can the people who are actually developing these things and then selling these things, it seems like it would be those sort of Black-Scholes underlying seems at least a little bit more simple to conceptualize. Is it possible that the person who's selling these things could understand the underlying risk characteristics of the product, and for that matter, the person buying it?
I think it's easier for options than for CDOs. I mean, options are sort of maybe mathematically more complicated, but the assumptions are clearer. It's when you're dealing with things that are collections of many other things, I think that it's much harder to figure out what the risks are. But say your question again, can the person selling it understand the risk?
So I guess something that I'm interested in is the extent to which the market makers and dealers understood the underlying risk profile of the derivatives they were creating. And something that's interesting to me is that as you look at sort of an evolution of derivative products from something that can be modeled in sort of a Black-Scholes style way, to moving now to something which looks like more of just sort of an actuarial statistical correlation question.
Yeah.
If you can't, I guess so. My question is, how is that reflected, if at all, in the way these things are actually sold into the market? The first part of the question is, can you describe a little bit, as you said, you worked at Goldman, the way that sort of the risk modeling interacted with the people who are actually on the floor selling the thing. And then second, do you have any sense of how that would have changed, whether that would have changed, as you move from, given the different kind of risk profiles of the product, sort of the different modeling risks?
I'm just trying to think. I mean, I'm only talking generically. I think most of the salespeople at Goldman were pretty smart in a visceral sort of way, as well as maybe numerate. But, I mean, more visceral. But I think, I don't know if people in mortgages or in CDOs, but generally people were pretty good about understanding the risks of their positions in a qualitative way and knowing what would hurt them. I don't know if that answers your question. I don't know how to do better.
I guess one of the surprising things that Alan Greenspan said was that these things are too complicated for anybody to be buying, and it makes you wonder, maybe a few traders understood the risks that were involved here, but is it possible that there could be a market in something that's this difficult to model? Is it appropriate?
CDOs really are. I mean, people model them. Again, I haven't always hands-on in CDOs, but I mean, you have to make more extreme assumptions to model a CDO that consists of 50 or 60 different bonds or synthetic CDO than you do for an option on a single index. And when you consider baskets of options, which people don't do that much, it gets much more complicated. So I think these things are complicated. On the other hand, I don't know how to be fair about this. If you think about a stock is a pretty complicated thing too, I mean, if you own a stock in Apple, you own stock in some company that's manufacturing in China and running stores in all over the world and making new products. It's not a simple thing either. And people value it every day, but there's a big market in it. I think the mistake people make with CDOs is to think you can come up with a AAA rating for it. I think the stock is at least as complicated as a CEO if you look at a stock in some big worldwide company. And it's just that nobody tries to model a stock in this sort of full, very quantitative way. Whereas, you know, nobody tries to model the credit of a company. You say it's AAA in some mathematical way, whereas when they start doing this with CEOs, they sort of get deluded by the precision of their model into thinking they can come up with a very accurate number.
So that really raises the question whether the rating agencies, you know, were using the right models or should have even claimed that they were able to.
Yeah, I think that's a better way. I'm sort of philosophical about this. I don't think there is a right model because nobody knows. It's not like trying to shoot a rocket to the moon where you know the law of gravity and the way people feel about gravity on a given day isn't going to affect the way the rocket behaves. You know, but there is no right model for valuing even an option or a CDO. You know, all you can do is look at the market and then make some, if it's a liquid thing, and then make some assumptions about how the world might differ from that. I think it's deluding people to say you can calculate an accurate value for these things.
So one solution would just be to say these things shouldn't be rated because they represent a lot more than simple credit risk, which is what the rating agencies are supposedly expert in.
Yes, I think maybe it is caveat, you know, caveat emptor. It's complicated, but. Certainly, I'm not sure what's the right regulatory solution, but I wouldn't trust their models. The models are only as good as the models and only then as good as the assumptions that go into them. And for CDO models, I think those were extreme. But it's driven by people selling these. Look, but I'm trying to be fair about this. People sold convertible bonds for years before they had derivative models for them. And if somebody and they're not as complicated as CDOs, but they're also pretty sophisticated, and there's been a world for them, there's been a market for them long before people knew. Some people still don't exactly know how to value them, but since long before Black-Scholes is what I'm trying to say. But people, I suppose on the buy side, people buy these things on the basis of. On the basis of some expected rate of return. There are people in the mortgage market, when I was there like 20 years ago, but even somebody used something called option-adjusted spread. I don't know if you know what that is.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, clients kind of crave a number. You know, I think what people use a lot of these models for the world's very complicated. They take corporate bonds. They're bonds with many different coupons, many different coupons and many different maturities. And people quote them all by yield to maturity, which may be the right way to look at it, although it's not bad. But they do it because they want some one-dimensional scale on which to judge these things and say, this one gives me a better yield than that.
Mm-hmm.
Or this one gives me a better option-adjusted spread than that. And I think people immediately who sell these things try to look for some metric that they can, and reasonably try to look for some metric that they can quote you to say this has a higher score than that. And I think that's what they use these models for to some extent.
I have a question about a specific model. Moody's had something called the binomial expansion technique. Are you at all familiar with that?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
All right, go ahead.
How about the Gaussian copula?
Literally.
Okay.
Could you give a sort of layman's explanation of how it's supposed to work and what the assumptions are and what sort of weaknesses it might have?
Yeah, it's, I'm not sure how good a job I can do, but I can try. I mean,
okay.
what the Gaussian coupler does is, or what coupler models do in general is, when you're dealing with a lot of different underliers, and you know how each one behaves, so you've got what people call the sort of marginal distributions, the distribution of bond 1 and bond 2 and bond 3, and the rate at which, say, they default. But what you'd really like to know is the relation between a bunch of different things, you know, where you've got a security that depends on bond A and bond B and bond C and et cetera up to bond Z. And you know how each one of them behaves, but you don't know how they behave relative to each other. And what the Gaussian coupler does, it's really a mathematical technique. It's not an economic thing. It exists long before David Lee. It lets you, and I want to stress, it lets you make assumptions, which in the case of a Gaussian coupler are Gaussian assumptions about how to put together two or more individual distributions into a joint distribution. Am I sort of being clear?
Yes, yes.
And it's really a mathematical assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And then your question is, so it's letting you take default probabilities for a bunch of individual bonds and produce a default distribution for all of those bonds together. So it's sort of like a fancy way of doing correlations, but a more flexible way of doing correlations. But it's just a statistical technique. I'm saying it's different from Black-Scholes in that it's not saying if you put together all these individual bonds and you hedge. I'm making a side comment here. It's not saying if you know all these different things and you carry out the following hedging process, you can create the complicated thing. It's simply saying, this is what Black-Scholes does. It's simply saying, if I make the following assumption, I can write down a mathematically consistent joint distribution from a bunch of individual distributions.
Okay, I got you.
And then it's up to you, or up to the world, and people use, I don't know, there are other copulas, T, I forget what it's called, Stephen T, and a bunch of others, and people make different assumptions about them, how to sandwich these things together into a joint distribution.
All right, thank you.
And I was going to say something, and then I think the other thing that's tricky about those models is that what they're trying to do is go from distributions of default, individual distributions of default to a joint distribution of default, but then we get back to what I was saying before in that it's very hard to observe even individual default distributions because you don't see bonds default very often.
Is there no better answer? Or I mean, from what I understand, the way this model under David Lee's way of doing it, which the market followed, was based on CDS of underlyings.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems a little circular. The market's telling, if you're using CDS to price, to come up with the joint distributions to me, but I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah. Although, I mean, everything in. Yeah. I mean, it is taking individual CDS It's taking individual CDS of individual bonds to back up the default probabilities of individual bonds, and then do them together with the Gaussian coupler to do it for the whole parcel.
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of circular, but it's not. I'm trying to be fair. If you look at the market and you look at the market for S&P options and then you run it backwards through Black-Scholes and get the implied volatility that the market's attributing to the S&P in order to calculate something else that's also a little bit circular.
Hmm.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, but Professor, isn't the difference between those two examples the fact that in one situation with the Black-Scholes-Merton formula and the options markets, you actually have an underlying historical data set of a liquid market, whereas when you're trying to use a different model for CDOs, you don't have similar liquidity, similar historical data, and as you said, the predictability of the model for CDOs is far less than the Black-Scholes-Merton formula.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't like to say predictability so much. I mean, but I agree with you. What you're trying to do is say, you're never trying to predict what will be worth in the future. You're trying to make assumptions about what the correlation will be in the future so you can say what it's worth today.
And then also, Professor, I mean, in utilizing the Gaussian copula model as part of the aggregation of the individual distributions, aren't there assumptions that have to be made related to the differences, the potential differences in those individual distributions, sort of the randomness of those distributions in order to come up with a more accurate aggregate distribution?
Just say it again, I'm sorry.
Just to get a better understanding of the Gaussian copula models and the use of those, when you're taking individual distributions and in essence you're trying to find a way to mathematically aggregate those individual distributions to come up with one sort of aggregated level of distribution. In order to do that, there has to be some way to adjust for the differences that may exist between the varying individual distributions to make the final result more accurate, correct? How is that done, do you know?
You mean to take account of the uncertainty individual distributions?
That's right. In other words, there's got to be variance between the individual distributions that has to be taken into consideration in order to come up with a more accurate aggregate distribution?
Yes.
And so...
I don't know, although I think the other thing about the Gaussian copula is that it tends to use an average correlation. You know, to glue them together, it assumes some average value for all of the correlation between the different distributions.
Okay, so it's trying to find some mean. Okay, as opposed to injecting...
Part of the trouble with this stuff is, I think in some sense, if you trying to sell something, it's fair to try to figure out what it's worth in some way. The trouble with these deals is not, the trouble isn't that people did them, but that people did so many of them. You know, I mean, the sense that it's just a small corner of the market, and it's not driving, if it doesn't interact with the whole economy to such a large extent, it wouldn't matter that much.
Right, it would be sort of a contained experiment.
Yes, I mean all of the stuff is, but it sort of grew very rapidly from nothing to a massive market based on a bunch of models, you know. It's a little scary. In addition to the extreme dependence on calculation.
Okay, so Professor, to try to summarize a little bit about what you've discussed here. In essence, the models upon which the CDO valuations were made were highly lacking. And in order for there to be a future market that is more stable, there seems to be a need for a more suitable model in the future. Is that correct?
I agree with the first part. that they were highly lacking. I'm just not sure. You know, I'm evading a little bit, but I think somehow people who don't work with this stuff somehow imagine that there is a better model out there, or that there is a right model out there, and I don't think there's a right one, so people have to be a lot more cautious.
Right. No, Professor, what I'm actually saying is that a suitable model doesn't even exist at this point.
Yes.
Okay, and until such a suitable model exists, assuming it can exist sometime in the future, a market in these particular types of instruments may not be such a good idea in the particular way in which the market existed in the past.
I think if everybody down the marketing chain of this stuff had to put more of their own skin in the game, they would all be more careful. You know, it's too easy to... I don't know what the solution to anything is, but it's too easy to sort of make a buck and be rid of the risk. Although then you look at Merrill and Bank of America, and they sort of ate their own cooking, and it still didn't really help. So, yeah, I kind of agree with you.
Yeah, the other problem with having them keep a skin in the game is that they turn around and hedge it, and that's part of the that's the key part of their strategy anyway. And
yes.
How do you regulate that?
I don't know. You know, Jim Grant, he's this guy who writes the Grant's newsletter.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Interest Rate Observer.
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of a little like a stop clock that's always saying the same thing, and then he's right every few years. But he had some fairly humorous column a couple of weeks ago saying that in Brazil, everybody who runs a financial business is. There's no limited liability. You're personally on the line. So if things go wrong, and so people are much more cautious. And certainly, Goldman and all of these places, when they were partnerships, you know, their capital. This is a more sociological thing. Their capital was tied up in the place for the next 10 or 15 years, even when they retired. So you know, they weren't paid in cash. They were illiquid. So. There was less of much less of an incentive to do risky things with your own money. If you can't get out of it right away.
I guess, Professor, the contrary argument to that would be that in order to make their non-cash compensation worth something in the future, they had to continue to propagate the market and keep the market going, even if they knew that their actions were not appropriate, because without that market being in existence, their non-cash compensation would go down.
Well, are you saying that them being illiquid was an incentive to do something bad or to do something good?
Well, in other words, they had to continue doing something bad in order to keep liquidity. And because without liquidity, their non-cash compensation would become worth little to nothing.
You mean before they were public?
I would say potentially even after they were public, because there was a lack of transparency still.
Okay, let's see if I'm saying the same thing. I was sort of saying that before they or everybody else went public, if somebody next to you did something that was going to endanger the firm or its reputation 10 years from now, your money, I wasn't a partner, but if you were a partner, your money would still be tied up in there. And so I think you're incentivized to be more careful.
I get it. On a long-term basis.
For a long-term basis,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
So
you couldn't afford scandal, and you couldn't afford You didn't have stock. You had some sort of phantom shares in the company. And when somebody couldn't get out of there that quick. I mean, they weren't allowed to get out of there, I think. And I agree with what you said. There was too much dependence on models that. I mean, all financial models, especially derivatives models, look much more. They use a mathematical language that looks much more precise than the underlying assumptions. You know, they've got a patina of accuracy which isn't really there. Although it doesn't mean people shouldn't use them, but it's easy to lose sight of the fact that nothing's as accurate as the mathematics looks. And certainly with S&P and Moody's, I don't know that much about it firsthand, but it seems to me. They were rating things more accurately, and maybe with the wrong, you know, with a conflict of interest than they ought to have. But I don't know whether it's the sellers that are buying this or the buyers. Whether it's the sellers that are driving this or the buyers. I mean, it seems to me there was just as much demand for high yield in a low yield environment on the buy side. I mean, you read about, you know, people putting money in Icelandic banks in England on the internet because they got a little bit more interest. Well, they promise a little bit more interest. I have a hard time figuring out whether it's people trying to get rid of mortgages or people demanding high yield that is driving all of this above.
Well, I mean, to what extent should we blame the rating agencies for claiming that they'd modeled something that wasn't modelable?
Yes. I'm asking my opinion.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah. No, it's that's the only opinion we're looking for.
Yes. Yes, and I suppose that applies to quants too. Although it's kind of harder because you know. I think the rating agency shouldn't get blamed for pretending they can say something accurately. But you know, the other thing that this is more a sociological comment, and I've worked on Wall Street. I don't know what it's like now, but on the one hand, if you're a quantitative person, you don't quite trust your model. Trust is the wrong word. If you don't believe your model is predictive or is very accurate, you ought to tell people. And Paul Wilmot and I once wrote about a year ago some like financial modelers manifesto, you know, saying how people should tell their bosses or whoever they're working with exactly, you know, how inaccurate or how unreliable or what assumptions their models are based on. But you're often fairly low down on the totem pole, you know. And I imagine there are a lot. I'm running to people rating agencies, and I imagine their bosses probably don't want to listen to them very much. That's conjecture, but I'm saying yes. I think they should be more careful. But there's sort of a mismatch between the people who I suspect there's still a mismatch between the people who do the mathematics and build the models and the people who market them or who demand them. But yeah, I think it's wrong.
I guess we should have asked first what your background is, so we could kind of target the questions a little bit. But after working at Goldman, can you tell us a little bit more about what you've been up to?
Before or after or both?
I guess both, and I apologize for not asking before.
No, it's no problem. I came to graduate school in this country, to Columbia, to study physics, and I got a PhD in physics in 1973. And I worked as a physicist in various universities between 1973 and 1980, doing research mostly in particle physics. And then from 1980 to 1985, I worked at Bell Labs.
Sorry.
And then in 85, I went to work at Goldman in fixed income derivatives, where I worked for a while with Fisher Black, and I'm building sort of option models for bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to price options on treasury bonds, and I was at Goldman I spent 3 years at Goldman from 85 to 88, and then I spent 1 year at Salomon Brothers in those days in 89, working on adjustable rate mortgage models, so that's where I know something about mortgages. And then I came back to Goldman and spent 10 years in equity derivatives in charge of a group called Quantitative Strategies that built equity derivatives models for trading all kinds of equity derivatives and built trading systems. So it was like half software, half modeling from 90 to 2000. And then I spent 2.5 years in firm-wide risk, which is what I mentioned before, looking at and running a group that used to try to check the traders' marks and risk on individual sort of structured products, mostly derivatives. And then I left there in the middle of 2002, and I've been at Columbia since then, although I work one day. I run a financial engineering master's program at Columbia, but I also work one day a week at a sort of fund of hedge funds in New York.
So you've essentially been in the market, in the hedge fund business, for the past 8 years as well.
Yeah, 7 years. Yeah, but it's in a fund of funds, so more doing due diligence in terms of visiting individual funds and looking at their risk management and trying to understand. So it's not really a trading business; it's a sort of investment business. I'm on the risk management side.
Oh, I see. So,
we don't buy securities. We go to visit hedge, you know. The firm tries to get money from pension funds or mutual funds and invest them in a mutual funded hedge funds, and goes around visiting hedge funds to do due diligence on them and tries to decide what the best portfolio to put together of individual hedge funds is.
So do you have a view about what happened in August 2007 to the quantitative hedge funds, to a handful of them?
Only what I've read. I mean, I'm being apocryphal. I don't really know firsthand, but it sounds like what happened was there was a big liquidity crunch, and when the market started going bad, and when other markets started going bad, and people were in the quantitative funds, a lot of their models are all very similar. You know, you even speak to people in different places, and nobody will tell you exactly what they're doing. They'll tell you in a qualitative way, if you're lucky, but they won't really tell you what their model is. But I think a lot of them are based on mean reversion for stock trading, and a lot of them, in some general way, I think their underlying models probably go along the same stock and short the same ones, and when they all needed cash, if they were multi-strategy funds and they had other things that were bad, they all started unwinding their positions at the same time. But you know, I don't think that was an economic event. I mean, I think that's very different. I think, subject to me, but that's very different from what happened with the subprime mortgage business. And in a sense, the crash of 87 was a big technical financial event, but it didn't affect the economy in the end.
Right.
And I think the 2007 quant sort of a quant crisis that lasted for a couple of days, it's hard to draw a firm line, but it was sort of a technical event of a lot of people doing a lot of things because of a liquidity squeeze. And it didn't have a lot of economic consequences, well, it was kind of exciting. It hurt the hedge funds to the extent the things they traded actually came back within a few days, but they lost money, some of them, because when they lost money long-term, because when the market went down, they got scared and they unwound the positions before they came back. So it did have some economic consequences, but not on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what happened the other day a week ago on the flash trading on the market's $1,000 drop, that was also a technical thing, but that sort of somehow played into the fear and sort of has economic consequences.
Right.
So there isn't a sharp dividing line, but I still think the 2017 was less. I mean, it's also connected with a model failure in a sense, because their models probably don't take account of what's going to happen. What's going to happen if everybody, as you said, follows their behavior at the same time?
Professor, in comparing those different examples that you just suggested, is one of the primary differences the level of interconnectedness or interconnection within the systems?
The differences between which and which?
In other words, let's just say since 87, for instance, the level of interconnectedness, it seems, has exponentially increased.
Yes.
And that seems to be maybe potentially the reason why it went from being a technical issue to an economic-wide issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, globally, things are more interconnected. I mean, because there are a lot of... Yeah, I mean, you're right, the quantitative thing. In a way, there were multi-strategy funds who were trading other things, and then when they got impacted for liquidity, they ended up inflicting their problems on the equity market briefly because of the interconnectedness, yeah. You're right.
So let's just say with your background, you're put into a policy position, policy-making position. What suggestions would you have to help to mitigate the potential contagion that could result from a market scare or a technical problem going into the future? In other words, how do you reduce systemically the interconnectedness within the financial markets?
That's a good question.
And it may be outside of the scope of what you feel, you know, comfortable in opining.
I'm certainly not competent on that issue, but I'm trying to think. I mean, I have no historical authority to talk about that, but I don't know. I'm not listening. I was reading the paper about, you know, the New York Stock Exchange putting in a trading halt, but then the other exchanges, because the electronic market for stocks is now kind of fragmented. So apparently, even when people stopped, I'm just repeating what I read. I mean, somehow things propagated. Even when people try to slow down, the slowdown just had a worse effect. It's kind of tricky. I don't know. I think people are too. I had a side remark. I think people are too excited about efficiency. You know, and a lot of people go around saying, if we do this or we do that, the market will be less efficient. And I think you're right. One needs to decouple things in a way which is less efficient, but it would be better to decouple it in some way. People could slow down the coupling.
About interconnectedness, there's been arguments that the crisis was in part caused by institutions being too interconnected. There's another argument that says this is an interconnection. What you're observing is a common shock to all institutions. Is there a way to differentiate those two scenarios, like tested in the data?
Not that I know. I mean, maybe you can look at the time sequence of correlations, but I don't really know.
Okay.
I don't know what the solution to all of this is, but I don't think the solution is a better model. I think the solution is somehow, putting more skin in the game, but
right.
But I think the solution is making it easier for the world to make people suffer the consequences of their actions.
Right. Right. Well, just to, I guess, put some flesh on the bones, one of the arguments about interconnectedness is if we had a central clearinghouse, this would eliminate a lot of the complexity and the interconnectedness, and therefore would help the financial system. But if it were, in fact, a common shock, having the clearinghouse wouldn't do anything at all.
I think that's true. I mean, I think that's true, although it would have to be a much bigger common shock. Okay. I mean, a clearinghouse would only protect you against a small number of people going bad. When the whole world goes bad, then,
right.
It's the same thing. Yeah, then you're not protected, but I think it's still better than not having one.
Okay.
And, it's like all these guys who, I'm rambling a bit, but it's like all these guys who are doing statistical arbitrage and high-frequency trading and saying they're really doing it to provide liquidity. But it's only liquidity when people don't need it or when people
right.
need it to manage. So, I don't know. I think the central clearinghouse is still prone to trouble, but it's 1 degree more protected. And I suspect the people who argue against it's like there's the Samuel Johnson thing about patriotism being the last refuge of scoundrels. And I'm saying I think people argue against it. It's against their self-interest. It's got to be better having it. It seems to me it's got to be better having a clearinghouse than not having one. Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was just using that example, that there are actually differences between these two scenarios, and if we could go back and, differentiate ex ante, that might be helpful to the report.
Whether it's a separate shock or a
common shock, or it's a result of interconnectedness.
You mean, are you talking about some specific event?
Well, I suppose. I wasn't thinking of any specific event, but perhaps the test could come from specific events. But the basic idea being, is there a way to empirically show that these interconnections are causing an independent cause of the crisis? Am I making sense?
Yeah, you are. I don't know enough about whether there's a precise way to answer that. I kind of doubt it.
Okay.
You're saying whether the shock across all, whether what happened across all markets were one big shock or whether it propagated?
Right. Well, basically, yes. The test would be simply, or the proposition would be, did interconnectedness exacerbate the crisis, or is this just a red herring? And so you know, presumably it would add an extra, I guess, a fillip or something like that to the damage that was caused. But, you know, the difficulty of demonstrating that from the evidence, you know, is interconnectedness bad in itself? And I guess one implication of that is if you have an institution like Bear Stearns where they say it's too interconnected to fail, you know, if this were in fact a false premise, then you wouldn't rescue Bear Stearns.
I think it's kind of, I mean, there probably are people analyzing all the links of Bear Stearns or Lehman to, mm-hmm. or AIG.
Yeah, it sounds like it might be outside of your expertise, and I don't mean to dwell on it.
No, it's interesting. I mean, somehow, yeah, it's interesting. I don't know, but I suspect you won't get an unambiguous answer to it.
Okay.
Okay, well, I guess, I mean, one other model that's being criticized a lot is the VAR model. So do you have a view on those and how they're used?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are, again, I don't think, it's the same thing. People are trying to give you, it's like what I was saying about option-adjusted spread or yield to maturity. People are trying to give you one number, you know, that will say this is more risky than that. And it's not really capturable in one number, and it's better having it than nothing. I disagree with Martin Taleb. It's not useless, but it's better than nothing. But you don't want to take it as gospel either. And people try to be better, but one thing that impressed me when I was at Goldman, this was in the early 2000s, that people didn't just rely on one metric. You know, they didn't just rely on VAR. They looked at stress tests and what would happen to their P&L under a range of different scenarios, like 87 repeating or long-term capital in the Russian default crisis repeating. And so they didn't have one number that they just relied on. And so I don't think VAR is useless, but again, I think it's a fallacy to think that somebody's going to come up. I don't get emails from people in Europe or, you know, Swiss mathematicians who think that they've got a better formula for calculating risk. And it may be a better one, but I honestly don't think the solution... Look, I think people did rely on VAR too much, but I don't think the solution is finding a lot better number either. I still think the solution is more regulatory than mathematical.
And how does that work?
No, and just not letting people... I don't know, I am out of my comfort zone, but not letting people take on as much leverage, and I come back to sort of, if they take the upside, look, they should have taken the downside. Now, I know they didn't, but I think that would caution people more.
So that gets us to too big to fail, and maybe the government overextending itself. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, it's too big to fail, and people getting paid 100 cents on the dollar on risky securities that got bailed out. I don't want the whole financial system to collapse. I don't know what's the right way to do it. I mean, you don't want the whole world to collapse. There's something wrong about firms being on the verge of extinction and then making giant profits after having been saved. So yeah, I think too big to fail is
And then, Professor, just to also bring back something that you stated earlier, you mentioned that over-reliance upon models seems to be an issue as well.
Yes.
So just to sort of summarize some of the things you just mentioned to make sure that we've got our notes and everything correct, basically... over-reliance upon one model versus multiple models is an issue. You don't want too much reliance upon models, period. And then also there needs to be very careful attention to the regulatory framework that deals with some of probably in a lot of ways the psychological issues as well as just the practice issues such as compensation, having skin in the game, and various things that will cause human behavior to change so as to mitigate the risk to the overall economy, the systemic risk, and at the same time not allowing the upside to go to investors while the downside goes to the taxpayers.
Yes.
Is that a good summary sort of what's maybe your view on things is at this point?
Yes. I don't know how you do that. I mean, I don't know what was the right thing to have done in this crisis. I argue with people sometimes when they say, you know, if you didn't bail out people, the whole world would have come to an end and all this is working. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but yeah, that's the first, what you said is the first summary. Actually, I was going to send you, when we finish, can I send you two papers? One, I've got an old paper that I wrote, but short, about marking illiquid products and using several different models. It's a qualitative paper.
That would be great.
Another one is about models in general, which is in the Financial Analyst Journal about a year ago, and sort of what I was saying about the difference between finance models and physical science models.
Great. And you want to send the manifesto, sounded like a fun one to read, too.
Say that again?
You mentioned the quant manifesto.
Oh, yeah, I can send you that, too.
That sounds interesting.
But, yeah, I think that's a fair summary.
Great. Is there? I guess before we sign off, is there anybody else that you think we should talk to help us understand, you know, models, derivatives, credit rating agency failures?
I think Rick is somewhere down in your end. Rick Bookstaber.
I guess I'm not supposed to say this, but he was just in yesterday.
Okay. Well, I know he works down there now.
Yeah, he's at the SEC. That's right. He was very interesting.
Yeah, so he's a smart guy, and he's got a lot of. He also worked in risk management and derivatives, so he knows a lot.
Anybody else in risk management who actually knows? I shouldn't say. I'm trying to think of a better way to say this. Who knew what they were doing?
I'm trying to think. He's certainly got a lot of experience, both on the hedge fund side and on the sell side and buy side,
mm-hmm.
and academic side. I'm trying to think. I can't think offhand.
Okay. Well, you know, if you think of somebody, or if you can think of any articles that could help that you've read that could help us, we don't want to miss any.
But I think people. I mean, this is just sort of on the fuzzy side, but I think people do take too much comfort from models, and I mean, you've got to try to use them. I think there's no alternative to using models, but when you use a financial model, you really got to look over your shoulder all the time and ask, what's wrong with what I've done, or what could go wrong with what I've done, or what are the assumptions? And if you look honestly at the assumptions, you can see that they're quite likely to be ridiculous. So that the circumstance under which they're... I mean, I worked on something called the Black-Durbin-Clay model, which is like a model for fixed income options, and people, I think they still use it, but people use it a lot at one point, like 20 years ago, and it's a reasonable model, but if you say to yourself, if you recite to yourself the assumptions that you're making, and then you say, do you think the world really works that way, you've got to say to yourself, very unlikely. I mean, maybe it's not a bad approximation, but if something drastic happens, nobody's going to look at the world the way your model looks at the world. Do you follow what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it makes you wonder why, you know, people weren't pointing this out about the Gaussian copula when it was first proposed as a way to not just value but rate a huge number of securities.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not. I never looked at the Gaussian copula. I never worked on that stuff. But certainly, yeah. I'll send you this paper that's at least 10 years old from Goldman.
Yeah.
Where I think you've got to use the models with sort of hubris to the extent that. You try to push them as far as you go, but then at the end you've got to say, you know, do I really believe this, you know?
Right. So, thank you. I mean, you have our email, so please send along those papers. And, you know, even over the next month or so, if you think of anything else that would be helpful that, you know, that's been bugging you, that seems to have been a factor here, just go ahead and we'd really love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, if you ever think of anything, I'm happy to talk again, but I'll email you these papers in a little while.
Great.
Yeah. Professor, we really appreciate your time and all of your contributions.
Okay, my pleasure. It was interesting. Thanks.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks. website. Bye.
Bye. Okay.